I heard 50s pop music growing up in the car. My parents used to play the soundtrack to American Graffiti. I came of age myself in the early 70s, and Happy Days was a huge hit show when I was a kid, and I loved Happy Days. But as I got older, I think I was curious to sort of look beyond that cheerful, starched facade of the 50s.
You write about how this isn't an era in music that a lot of music critics have explored, and you write something very interesting, that this kind of music has never been taken seriously because a girl has never bothered to examine it. What did you mean by that?
I grew up very influenced by male rock critics. I read Rolling Stone, Musician. These magazines were almost entirely written by men. And the music that rock historians tend to highlight in favor is music that emphasizes rebellion and sex and the loosening of morals, from the time of Elvis shaking his hips on through the late 60s, Summer of Love. And the pop music that's always been intertwined with rock history has never been written about because it tends to represent the status quo that rock and roll was rebelling against. But that pop music, which tends to be more about romance and love as opposed to sex and drugs, I think appealed to teenage girls who were sucked in by these images of finding the perfect boyfriend or having a broken heart and songs that were meant to ease a broken heart. So I think over the years, these pop songs have been cast aside because they didn't kind of promote these images that we all like to think about in terms of the 50s and the late 60s, that boomer generation of rebellion and revolution. They were sort of the opposite.
So you decided that you're going to explore this uncharted territory. You start collecting vintage LPs of Patti Page, Pat Boone, Connie Francis, and you sit down one afternoon to listen to them, to really dig in, and you hit a wall. Tell us about that.
Well, I found out as I started listening to all of it that in many cases it lived up to the reputation that rock critics had assigned to it, which was it was often sort of bad, cheesy, and sometimes even inept. One singer who I wrote about, Tommy Sands, who was an Elvis clone who had hit records right at that time that Elvis went into the army. When I went back and listened to some of this stuff, it really sounded as though it was made by people who really didn't understand rock and roll but were jumping on a bandwagon. And so I felt incredibly embarrassed at times. How am I going to rescue and revive this music if, in truth, some of it isn't that good? And what happened was that as I kept going along and listening to it more and more, I was almost able to hear it more with innocent ears, the ears of a teenager as opposed to the ears of a jaded rock critic. The innocence in a lot of this stuff became very appealing to me. So even though some of it ended up not being so good, I found myself able to embrace and enjoy it anyway.
We have this sliding scale here at the station that we use when bands send us their new CDs, and it reminds me very much of what you're talking about. It's this idea of the artist versus the musician, that as good as a band or a singer might be, if they're not writing their own music, if they're just playing cover songs or trying out new genres that they don't really understand, they're not as much of an artist as a group that has a vision, that writes their own music, and that evolves. Where do you think that singers like Pat Boone and Connie Francis and Patti Page fall on this type of scale?
Well, you could look at them on, I love that idea of a sliding scale, by the way. And you could look at this stuff on either side of that. On the one hand, you can say because these people weren't songwriters and because a lot of them were under the sway of really powerful managers who were very slick and savvy and knew what was good in the marketplace and knew what kids wanted, you could look at it from a sort of jaded point of view. But that sort of idea of authenticity didn't even really take hold in pop music until the Beatles and Bob Dylan. They were really the turning point. There were singers before then who wrote their own material. Even Paul Anka, who had huge hits in the late 50s, wrote a lot of his own stuff. But that idea of a singer-songwriter putting forth a personal vision that only he could articulate, whether he had a perfect voice or not, that was really something that happened with Bob Dylan and with John Lennon and Paul McCartney. So it's almost like holding those pre-Beatles singers to a standard that didn't even exist. It's a little unfair. And the other thing is that because singers sang and songwriters wrote, because those distinctions were so much firmer in the 50s, singers really had to be great singers. They had to have good pitch. They had to be able to emote. They had to be able to sell a song. So a lot of these singers, although I must say not all, because Fabian is one of the people in the book too, but a lot of them really had fantastic voices when you compare them to even great rock singers like Bob Dylan or Mick Jagger, who are certainly, you know, very moving, but aren't technically great singers if you want to just look at their singing ability in and of itself. So they had a lot of strengths to recommend them.
But the fact of the matter is that as Bob Dylan and the Beatles became so popular, these artists who had huge hits, been at the top of the charts in the 1950s, saw their careers fizzle and basically disappear. And you track down seven of these aging pop stars. What are they doing now?
They're all at different levels, and some of them are at surprising levels of success today. Fabian, who's never had a good reputation among rock critics because he wasn't a real singer, Fabian tours for a good part of the year and has a very, very successful niche touring with other singers of the 50s and 60s. And he remains incredibly popular and also has a pretty good, settled life. Tommy Sands is somebody who's struggled a lot more. He unfortunately has fought mental illness, he told me, since an early age. And he's been very debilitated by that. Doesn't have close family, doesn't have too many people around to take care of him. When I met him, he didn't have a phone, which was just so tragic to see somebody who had been a big star struggling that way. So they were all kind of at their own place. Pat Boone is still Pat Boone. He still mouths off about conservative issues, and yet he's still trying to come up with a new hit record. Yeah, they're all at different places.
One of the artists that seems to be at the center of your book is Connie Francis. And I know her song, Where the Boys Are, where it was almost a turning point for you and your decision to look into this genre. What was it like for you to meet her? She had such a reputation for being sort of a loose cannon, even when she was at her prime.
She did. I was very hung up on Connie Francis because she had really inspired the book. When I first received a box set of hers in the mail, she physically reminded me of my mother. And that was how I originally connected this music to the time of my parents' coming of age. So she was a very significant person for me, just in terms of my own exploration of what the music meant. When I met her, I would say she lives almost like someone who, in her own mind, is still a huge star. She had a bustling household. She had assistants. She had people installing furniture and carpets. Her mother was there. Her friend, who's the Bobby Darin impersonator, stopped by. It all felt about as hectic as backstage at Carnegie Hall after a sold-out show.
You write about Connie's devotion to her father and how he really guided her career away from anything risky or artistic and instead had her focus on being popular, on pleasing the masses, on putting out records that would be very appealing. Do you think that there's a resurgence of that approach in modern pop with singers like Jessica Simpson and the whole American Idol winner situation? Do you think that there's a resurgence of that?
I think there is, and it is easy to feel cynical about that. I find that I don't connect with the modern-day versions of the people in my book. In other words, the Jessica Simpsons and the Britney Spears, the teen idols of today. I think it's a much more cynical time that we're living in. The innocence seems even more packaged than it was in the late 50s. I think that benefit of hindsight, of something having been huge and successful and then becoming forgotten, made it a more interesting sort of treasure hunt for me. Whereas when you look around today and American Idol is everywhere and Britney Spears is on the cover of every tabloid, it's so overwhelming that I find myself wanting to run away from it.
Do you think in 50 years someone will be writing a book about the lost innocence of Jessica Simpson and Britney Spears?
I think that in 50 years, the Jessica Simpsons and Britney Spears of our day will have a similar revelatory value for people because they really are a mirror of the times that we're living in. And they show us at our best and our worst.
I've been speaking with Karen Schomer, author of Great Pretenders, My Strange Love Affair with 50s Pop Music. Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.